I don't know, I said, sighing. Everything was going great with us, and then Sadie preemptively dumped me because she thinks we won't last.
You probably won't, Nick said.
Thanks a lot.
Nothing lasts, he said. Even this awesome floaty feeling. We all reach for whatever we think is going to dull the pain, and sometimes we don't even want whatever it is, we just want to not be miserable, you know? So anyway, I'm sorry I was a dick.
It's fine, I said.
No, shut up, I'm atoning. We have 7 more weeks at Latham, and then all this is over. It's like the end of senior year. It's the last chance to go for things. Otherwise, you always wonder.
He shifted on the bed, coughing a little.
I want us to be cool so we can all keep in touch. That's all we're going to have left, you know? Each other.
He was right. Latham would close down and TDRTB would be curable. And it would be hard to explain to anyone who hadn't gone through it what it had been like at a sanatorium and what it was like to have this weird past that was filled with blood tests instead of standardized ones.
We're cool, I said. Don't worry about it.
Did I already ask if you want some codeine? Because it's awesome, like a trampoline.
Think I'll pass, but thanks. I went up to my room thinking about what Nick had said, even though he was pretty out of it. I didn't want to wonder about Sadie. I wanted to be with her. But I'd never given her a reason to think I really meant it. I'd never asked her to be my girlfriend, not officially. And I'd never said that I loved her. I'd taken the coward's path, telling her that I adored her and that I was crazy about her, using every other phrase that I could instead of the one that I meant. And now, even if I did muster the courage to say it, she wouldn't want to hear it. She might not even believe it.
Chapter 22, Sadie. I hadn't expected Latham without Lane to hurt as much as it did. I'd made a mistake, and I knew it as I lay in bed each night that week, alone and lonely, and no company except my own horrible thoughts. I had trouble falling asleep, so most nights I'd curl up on my side and stare out the window at the inescapable woods. I tried to see beyond them, past Whitley and the dust-covered avocado stands along PCH, all the way down the coast to Los Angeles, to home. But I couldn't. All I could see was Lane's face in the gazebo, the way he'd crumpled, the way he'd stared at me like I'd torn apart the universe and handed him the shreds. I hadn't known it would be like that. I didn't have experience with boys or experience with much of anything except having TB. But Latham House was closing down. It was like Nick had taken to saying that these were the last days of the Empire. He was wrong, though. The sun had already set on our little empire, which was the only one that really mattered. Our group was splintered. The energy that once made our table the center of the dining hall sucked dry. There was no empire anymore, just the ruins of a once great civilization, just the memories of a once great relationship. It took me 3 days to build up the courage to even sneak a glance at Lane again, and to stop pretending that whatever picture was in my fashion magazine wasn't the most fascinating thing in the world. And when I glanced at him, I wanted to cry. He looked the same as always, my Lane, with his floppy hair and green-brown eyes, except he wasn't mine at all. Not anymore. Marina knocked on my door the Thursday after I broke up with Lane. I was curled up in bed with Adele on repeat in this little nest of electronics and books and chargers, and she snorted when she saw me.
I see you've made a cave, she said.
I'm regressing. Next I'll sprout gills and slither into the pond, I said. Marina shook her head.
What's going on? She asked. I thought this was what you wanted. I don't know what I want, I said, except to sit in my mope cave.
Well, your mope cave has company. Marina shut the door and held up a USB stick.
I just talked to Nick, she said. Have you listened to this?
What is it?
It's Well, it's Charlie's album, she said. I sat up.
Charlie made an album?
Before he died, Marina said. He finished it, left it in a box on his bed.
I hated talking about Charlie. It made me feel like I was back there again, standing over Charlie's body, looking for his green light. But this was different. This was new.
Can we play it? I asked. Nick made you a copy, she said. So here, all yours. I've been listening to it on repeat all day.
She tossed the stick onto my bed. I stared at it.
Thanks, I said. He was coming to find us, you know, Marina said. Charlie. He knew he wasn't doing well. He was trying to say goodbye. That's why he was in the woods. Not because we guilted him into attending a toga party.
I stared at Marina.
She smiled sadly. Not that it's worth anything, she said. I just thought you should know.
She shut the door behind her when she left. I popped the stick into my laptop and plugged in my headphones and played it. I'd heard Charlie's music before, in snippets, a line, a chord progression, the acoustic version on the ukulele. But this wasn't a rough draft. It was his finished verse. It was Charlie back from the dead and sitting right there next to me, confessing everything about how it felt to be young and dying and terrified that there was something you still hadn't finished, that you wouldn't have enough time. When the album ended, I was sobbing. Charlie had barely finished making this, and I'd been so stupid to abandon Lane. We hadn't finished becoming anything yet because I'd been so terrified that whatever we were was only temporary. And I'd been so, so wrong. Being temporary doesn't make something matter any less, because the point isn't for how long, the point is that it happened. Like ancient Greece. Like Latham. Like Lane and me. I tried my best to smooth my ponytail, and I put on the last of my favorite lip gloss, which I'd been saving for a special occasion, and then I bolted down the stairs and knocked on the door of Cottage 6. It was evening, not too late, and this kid Tim opened the door looking puzzled. Thanks, I said, slipping in past him.
You're not supposed to be in here, he said, but I didn't care.
I ran up to the third floor and down the corridor to Lane's room. I knocked, and his voice called,
Come in.
Hi, I said. His room was a mess, piles of books, clothes, misery. It was so different from the pristine dorm room I'd made fun of a few weeks earlier. So much more lived in. He stared at me like I was the last person he'd expected to show up at his door.
Hi,
he said cautiously. I closed the door and stood there, staring at him, wondering what he was thinking. I'm sorry, I blurted. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to break up with you.
You didn't?
He asked, like he didn't quite believe me. No. It was the worst mistake I've ever made, and I brought tie-dyed shorts to summer camp, so that's saying something.
I remember those shorts, Lane said, grinning.
And then he wrapped me in a hug. He squeezed me so tightly that I could almost feel the holes in my lungs, the missing parts that TB had pressed out of me, and how being with Lane made me feel like I was whole.
I remember your braces, I teased. I remember your purple rubber bands.
I remember your red sunglasses.
I remember staring at you when we swam in the lake, thinking how beautiful you were.
You did not, I said.
Okay. Lane said guiltily. But I should have, and I should have told you a long time ago that I love you.
I stared up at him in shock, and he grinned down at me, all eyelashes and jawline making me feel shivery. Even after I broke up with you? I asked.
Oh, wait, well, now that you mention it, he joked.
Hey, I said, pretending to be mad. But I threw my arms around him and stood on my toes to kiss him, and right before I did, I said, And I love you, too. And then I kissed him like I wanted to make both of our med sensors explode.
Whoa,
Lane said after we pulled apart. I smiled at him.
We don't have to stop, I said.
We probably do.
He motioned toward his silicone bracelet. I'm pretty sure any more of that would set off nuclear warheads.
Yoga breaths, I told him. Nice and slow. In and out.
Who knew wellness would be good for something? He joked.
Shush, I'm trying to kiss you, I complained. And then my lips met his, and we didn't say anything at all.
Friday was the next collection, and of course Nick backed out at the last minute. Lane said he'd come with me, but I told him it was okay. I'd rather go on my own. I hadn't been in the woods since the night of the toga party. I'd been avoiding them, the way I'd avoided everyone. But Charlie wouldn't have wanted to ruin the woods for me, so I squelched my nerves down into a tiny, manageable little ball and set out that Friday night with my backpack and knit cap, walking the familiar path with my flashlight illuminating the trees. I was trying to make peace with the woods and to say goodbye to them. It was almost December, and a lot of the trees were skeletons now. It was easier to see the sky through the branches, and I could even make out some stars. I read once that we're all just dead stars looking back up at the sky, because everything we're made of, even the hemoglobin in our blood, comes from the moment before a star dies. I don't know why I was thinking about that, but it made a lot of sense right then that stars glow so brightly in their instant of death, and that Charlie's music was him glowing, and that the stars in the sky would one day burn out and become atoms inside of people who were sick with diseases we couldn't yet imagine. Michael was waiting for me in the clearing, hunched inside a heavy coat, even though it wasn't that cold out. Hey, I said, waving my flashlight beam up and down in greeting. He turned, and there was a strange expression on his face.
Just you? He asked.
Nick is the worst business partner ever, I said, rolling my eyes, which is particularly ironic since he'll probably wind up running a business. Michael coughed then, and it didn't sound good. You okay? I asked.
Not really, he said. Sick.
Cold season, huh? I asked. He stared at me, and I realized that he didn't have any bags with him. He hadn't brought our stuff.
TB, actually, he said, with this unsettling half-smile.
We stared at each other in the dark, and I didn't know what he wanted. I didn't know what to say, and I didn't know why I felt so nervous all of a sudden. I'm sorry, I offered.
You're sorry?
Michael laughed in a way that scared me.
Sorry? What does sorry do? Can it get my job back? Can it pay my rent or my child support?
No, I broke off, unsure what I was going to say.
What?
He said, raising his voice.
No, what?
No, it can't, but there's a new medication, I said.
Oh, that's right, the so-called protosilin, if that's even real.
He spat, taking a step toward me.
But it doesn't matter if the medicine is real or not. They're not giving it to people like me for months. I have to sit and wait. I could die before they have enough.
Michael was really frightening me. He didn't look scared. He looked furious. And then he took another step toward me.
You did this,
he accused.
You gave this to me. My life is over. I can't see my kid. I lost my job. I'm not supposed to leave my house, and I'm going to die from this. I'm going to die alone.
I stumbled back, trying to get away, but he lunged toward me, his fist connecting with my ribcage so hard that I couldn't breathe and everything seemed to shatter. I felt myself fly backward, and there was a sharp crack against the back of my head and something sticky like sap, but which probably wasn't sap. And then pain. So much pain. Everywhere, like I was drowning in it. Like galaxies were collapsing inside of me. The stars burning out, even though they were already dead. I was filled with twice-dead stars, and everything began to go black around the edges, and I tried to say something, anything, but all I could do was curl up on my side and cough in violent, gut-wrenching spasms. I could hear Michael saying, "Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!" And then the beep, 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 beep of my med sensor on high alert. And then darkness.
Chapter 23. Lane. Sadie said to meet her in the gazebo after the collection, but it was getting late and she still wasn't back. I waited, wondering where she was and wishing we had cell phones so I could have texted. I didn't know what would happen if she missed lights out. She could probably figure out some excuse. I just hoped she was okay. She'd seemed more tired lately and more pale than usual, but I was probably imagining things because of Charlie. I was scaring myself because I was alone in the dark and it was late and starting to get cold. Sadie would be back any minute with that silly red cap on her head, her backpack heavy with contraband, rolling her eyes over how that black market guy hadn't shown up on time. And then she'd tuck her chin against my jacket and grin up at me, and we'd share a quick goodnight kiss before dashing inside, with barely enough time before the nurse check to climb under the covers still dressed. I was listening to this playlist I'd made for her, headphones clamped over my ears. It was the story of us in music, except it wasn't finished yet. I had this plan that I'd add a new song every month so that the playlist would keep going as long as we did. It was sort of an electronic version of Adopting a Tree, which I'd done in the Carbon Footprint Awareness Club, but only because it had looked good, not because I'd actually wanted to. Keeping a playlist alive sounded much more me. I stared across the quad at the clock tower. 5 minutes until lights out. And as much as I didn't want to, I knew I should go inside, but I didn't budge. "Come on, Sadie," I thought, fiddling with my iPod. "Sadie will be back before this song ends," I thought. "And then, Sadie will be back before this next one ends." But she wasn't. The song was halfway through when the nurses came running out of the cottages. They raced toward the woods, their expressions grim. I glanced back at the dorms, at all the windows lit with everyone watching, at the kids spilled out onto the porches in their pajamas. And then I took off my headphones and heard that dark and terrible alarm. Beep, 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 beep. Beep, 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 beep. It was coming from the woods, and I knew beyond a doubt that it was coming from Sadie. Everything stopped cold, except time somehow marched grimly forward, because my heart was hammering, and there was a pounding in my ears and my head, and I just knew that something was deeply wrong with Sadie. Panic rolled over me, a dense fog of it choking me and blanketing everything. I scrambled to my feet in the moonlight, desperate for that horrible beeping to stop, even though what I really wanted was for it never to have happened in the first place. The nurses raced into the woods. Nurse Jim clicked on a flashlight, and I didn't even think before I plunged in after them. I didn't have a compass, but I remembered the general direction, the clearing she'd pointed out to me. I didn't know if she'd be there, but I had to try. "Wait!" I called. Nurse Jim turned. "Lane, get back inside," he said as a tall brunette nurse crashed into the woods behind me. "I can't get a read on this location," she said, shaking her head. "Signal's too weak out here." "None of us can," Nurse Jim said. "We'll have to spread out and hurry." He glared at me. "Back inside now," he insisted. "I know where she went," I said desperately. "Please, I can show you." I didn't want for them to say that I couldn't. I just started running. My lungs burned and my chest ached, and I didn't realize how painful it would be until I'd already begun. I put my hand against a tree, catching myself and taking a ragged breath. "It's this way," I said, pushing forward and willing myself to keep going as I raced toward that terrible beeping. I knew something was wrong, and I wanted to kick myself for not realizing it earlier, for not going with her, for not insisting. And God, I wanted to kill Nick. "Sadie," I called. Sadie! But part of me knew she wouldn't answer. It was so dark in the woods, even with the thin, white beams of the nurses' flashlights. I could hear other nurses shouting to each other about how they couldn't get enough reception to track the signal, as the nightmarish beeping continued, getting louder and louder until the woods were pulsing in alarm. The clearing Sadie had told me about was just ahead, and I hurried toward it. Sadie, I called again. And then I saw her. She was curled on the ground at the base of a tree, an empty backpack next to her. At first, I thought she was sleeping, but then the beam of Nurse Jim's flashlight passed over her, and I saw that the back of her head was matted with blood. It wasn't the bright red of arterial blood. This was a different kind, darker and more urgent. No, I whispered, sinking to the ground next to her. There was a deep gash on her scalp like she'd been thrown against the tree, and she was so pale that her skin was almost translucent. I cradled her in my arms. She was so cold and her breathing was so shallow, but she was still alive. Sadie, I said, it's me. Please. Sadie. I was gasping for breath, and my heart had never beat so fast or so loud or so close in my ears. Softly, Sadie moaned. You have to step back, one of the nurses said, but he couldn't have meant me. And then his hands were on my shoulders, and he was lifting me away from her, and I was crying and screaming, and I couldn't catch my breath, but it didn't matter. Nothing mattered except Sadie being okay and not dead. What was she doing out here? One of the nurses wondered. Everything was starting to spin, and I leaned one hand against a tree and pressed the other against my hammering heart, struggling to breathe. Is she going to be okay? I asked. Please? Anyone? You've got to calm down, a nurse told me. Here, this will help. I felt a puncture, and then the whole world melted away. I awoke in a hospital room in Latham's medical building. It was just after 4 in the morning and eerily quiet. Something itched at my nose, and I reached up and unclipped an oxygen tube. I was still woozy from the sedative, and it took an embarrassing amount of effort to push myself out of bed and stand without swaying. My brain was so foggy that I couldn't quite remember why I was there or where there was. And then the fog cleared, and the events of that night hit me full force. Sadie lying on the ground in the woods, that gash on the back of her head, her shallow breaths, the way the nurses had surrounded her like she wasn't a girl anymore but an emergency. I had to find her. I had to make sure she was okay. I shuffled into the quiet hallway. The nurses' station was at the far end, and a television played softly, flickering through the glass barrier. I'd never been upstairs in the medical building before. It was a small ward, not a full hospital, and I found Sadie's name scribbled on the door plaque 2 rooms down from mine. I tiptoed in, hoping desperately that I'd find her awake. I pictured her laughing at my terrible bedhead, then smiling sleepily and asking if I wanted to snuggle in with her until the nurses caught us. But of course that didn't happen. She was asleep, or unconscious, I'm not sure which. She looked so small in the hospital bed, and so delicate, with a collection of wires and tubes disappearing under the blanket. She looked nothing at all like the red-lipped girl in the knit cap who tramped through the woods at night with a backpack full of contraband. Hi, I whispered, but she didn't respond. I reached for her hand, wanting to hold at least that much of her. I remembered writing my phone number across the back of it and feeling her fingers flutter across my jaw as we kissed in the woods. I remembered twisting around on the swing ride at the fall fest, reaching toward her as she held out her hand, daring me to grab it and get a medium soda-sized wish. I could have used that wish now, but something told me it wouldn't have been big enough. I don't know how long I sat there before Sadie moaned softly and opened her eyes. "Hey, you're awake," I said, squeezing her hand. She winced, her face pale and drawn. "Where am I?" she whispered. "Medical building." She closed her eyes again. "Everything hurts," she whispered. "I think I'm actually made of pain." I looked around for something that would help, and then I spotted it. "Morphine pump," I said, guiding her hand over the button. "Nick would be so jealous." I waited for her to say something else, but a nurse came in. She was young and brunette and pretty, and she smiled when she saw that Sadie was awake. "Good morning, sweetheart," she said. And then she spotted me and frowned at my hospital gown. "Out," she insisted, daring me to argue. I staggered to my feet, still a bit unsteady from the sedative. "I'll be back," I promised Sadie, glancing over my shoulder. But her eyes were closed again, and I couldn't tell if she'd heard me.
Chapter 24. Sadie. I woke to beeping and pain and the smell of hospital. Lane was there, or maybe I just imagined him, telling me that I was in the medical building, that I was still at Latham. But it was the wrong part of Latham, the place you never wanted to wind up. There was the pinch of an IV and liquid flowing through it. It was all so hazy, so out of focus, a bad photograph of a blurry moment. And then darkness. I felt like there were knives inside of me, straining to get out. My head throbbed as though something had punched a hole in it, and I imagined myself escaping through that hole, flying outside of the pain and my body and being done. But I wasn't done. I had so much left here. I had something in my hand, a button, and the nurse was talking to me, saying to push the button for morphine. She explained as she helped me use it that it would take away the pain. But it wouldn't, because I'd been at Latham long enough to know that pain can't be taken away. It has to leave on its own. And I wasn't sure mine was the type of pain that wanted to go away. When I woke again, it felt much later, but I wasn't sure. I blinked up at the ceiling, trying not to cry from the horrible ache in my chest. I groaned softly, and Lane was there again, bending over me with an anxious look in his eyes. "Hi," he said. "You're here," I whispered. "They tried to kick me out, but I put up a fight," he said cheerfully, and then shrugged. "Not really. I'm two rooms down. I just snuck over." "Breaking the rules," I murmured. "Well, I learned from the best." Lane showed me how to raise my bed so I could sit up without actually sitting, and I realized he was wearing a hospital gown. "You're hurt," I mumbled. "Nah, they gave me a sedative and brought me up here to sleep it off. I'm pretending it hasn't worn off yet so I get to stay," he said with a lopsided grin. I tried to smile back, but I probably just winced. Lane held a cup of water to my lips, and I attempted to take a sip. "Wow, hot," he joked as it spilled, wetting the front of my hospital gown. "Keep it in your pants. I mean gown," I said. Lane chuckled, then suddenly went serious. "Sadie, what happened last night?" he asked. At first, I was confused what had happened. I was in the woods, and then, oh God. "Michael," I whispered, the horror of it flooding back until I was drowning in the memory of it. I told Lane everything that I remembered, that I'd gone alone to meet Michael, and that he'd told me he had TB and it was my fault. "That's bullshit," Lane said. "Who knows where he caught it?" "I know," I said, "but it was... he wasn't himself. He was in a rage.
He attacked me.
I'm gonna kill him,
Lane said, shaking his head.
Marina was right, I murmured, suddenly exhausted from so much talking.
People are afraid of us. We're their monsters. Except they're the ones who are afraid of what they don't understand. They're the ones who ruin everything.
I started to drift back to sleep.
Sadie?
Lane said. Wake me when the nightmare's over, I told him. And then I floated off on a sea of morphine.
Chapter 25. Lane. I wanted to stay with Sadie, but Dr. Behrens kicked me out, promising that her family would be there soon. When I'd asked him if she was going to be okay, he'd given me a patronizing smile and said that he sure hoped so. It felt strange exiting the medical complex and walking through Latham's quad and pathways on a Saturday afternoon, while everyone was lying in the grass with music and books and board games.
I was out of sync with Latham House again, I realized. No longer a part of its rhythms. I went straight back to Cottage 6 and knocked on Nick's door. He opened it looking awful. He was wearing his ratty bathrobe and his hair stuck out in a million directions. His face looked naked without his glasses.
How is she?
Nick asked desperately.
They wouldn't let me up.
He looked so concerned, like Sadie was his to be concerned about, and in that moment I hated him. I hadn't come to give him news about his friend. I'd come because it was his goddamned fault Sadie was lying in a hospital bed hurt with what the nurse said were two broken ribs and a concussion. And if I couldn't kill Michael, Nick was the next best thing. Not good, I said.
I should have gone with her.
Yeah, I said, an edge to my voice. You should have.
What's that supposed to mean? Nick asked.
That you should have gone with Sadie like you were supposed to, instead of getting drunk alone in your room.
Fuck you, Nick said.
Fuck you. I don't remember hauling back and hitting him, but I must have because he staggered backward with his hands over his face cursing, and my fist stung like hell. Instantly, I felt better, but I couldn't say the same for Nick.
Shit, that hurts,
he whined, revealing a trickle of blood over his eyebrow. Might want to disinfect that cut, I said. Good thing you keep alcohol in your room. I went back to see Sadie that evening. The nurse didn't want to let me in at first, but I kicked up such a fuss that Dr. Behrens came down to see what was going on.
Oh, Lane, Dr. Behrens said. I'd like to speak with you in my office.
So I followed him down the corridor to his office, where he grilled me on how exactly I'd known where to find Sadie. I told him what I knew, about how she was meeting some guy Michael from town who worked at the Starbucks, although I didn't know his last name. And then I filled in the part Sadie had told me, about how Michael had claimed he had TB and accused Sadie of giving it to him, and how he'd attacked her. Dr. Behrens sighed, looking grim.
You're sure about this? He asked.
Positive. He brought in the police next. Two middle-aged cops from town who put on surgical masks before talking to me, then asked me to go over it again. The whole thing took forever, and I was anxious to get up to Sadie's room and see how she was doing.
Is there anyone else we should talk to?
The beefier cop asked. I didn't even hesitate before throwing Nick under the bus with that one. Dr. Behrens finally took pity and let me go up to see Sadie, although not before making me put on a surgical mask and scrub the hell out of my hands. Sadie's family was already there. Her mom, young and pretty, with Sadie's blonde hair, filling out paperwork in a chair. Her sister Erica, 12 and gangly and dark-haired, playing a game on her phone.
You must be Lane, Sadie's mom said.
Her eyes smiled at me from above her surgical mask.
I'm Naomi, Sadie's mother.
Nice to meet you.
I almost stuck out my hand, a reflex, but remembered not to just in time.
Thank you so much for staying with her this morning, she said.
Of course.
While Sadie's mom didn't exactly seem thrilled to have me there, she at least let me stay. I told her that Sadie and I had been at summer camp together too, and she asked me how I'd liked it. I lied politely and kept up the small talk, because I wanted her to like me, because I was afraid she'd ask me to leave. I must have fallen asleep in the chair next to her bed, because when I woke up, Sadie was staring at me.
You're up, I said, stretching.
Shh, she whispered.
She looked slightly better, but still so pale. She tilted her head toward the hallway, eavesdropping.
Dr. Behrens was out there talking with Sadie's mom just outside the doorway. He gravely mentioned the fractured ribs and the concussion. But then his voice dropped lower, as he said that Sadie had suffered a small hemorrhage in the woods brought on by the attack. He was worried that if it happened again, she wouldn't survive it.
Her x-rays aren't hopeful, Ms. Price, Dr. Behrens said, and it took me a moment to remember that Sadie's parents were divorced. The ribs are a problem, and every time she coughs, there's a risk one of them will shift and puncture a lung.
Sadie's eyes filled with tears as the weight of what Dr. Behrens had said sank in.
Between the rib fractures and the damage from her tuberculosis, it isn't looking good, Dr. Behrens finished.
Is there anything we can do? Her mom asked.
What she needs is protosilin, Dr. Behrens said gravely.
But I thought that was 3 weeks away.
It is, and unfortunately she doesn't have that kind of time. I'm so sorry, Miss Price, Dr. Behrens said.
Sadie closed her eyes, blinking away tears. I reached for her hand and gave it a squeeze, wishing we'd never eavesdropped on that conversation. There are some things you shouldn't overhear, some things that are too terrible to comprehend when other people are discussing them, even though they're happening to you. Sadie didn't look so much overcome by sadness as defeated by it, and I don't know how I managed to hold it together. How I sat there, stroking the back of her hand, breathing raggedly but not crying, because I wasn't going to do that in front of her.
Lane, she said after a while.
Hmm?
I'm so sorry. I always felt like there was something off about me. And now I know. I'm broken.
It wrecked me all over again to hear her say that.
You're not broken.
Then how come I can't be fixed? She asked, shaking as she held back tears.
If I'm not broken, how come no one can fix me?
When Sadie's mom came back in, you could tell she'd been crying. Dr. Behrens trailed behind her, looking grim. Sadie squeezed my hand, and I squeezed back. And then I held her hand like they'd told us to at camp during off-ground trips, as though it would prevent us from being separated.
Sadie, good to see you're awake, Dr. Behrens said.
I heard you, she told him, out in the hallway.
Dr. Behrens blanched. Sadie's mom looked horrified.
I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, Dr. Behrens said, trying to put on a smile.
I just have one, Sadie said. Can you give me the medication for multidrug-resistant TB?
I hadn't been expecting that at all. But the moment she said it, a small flicker of hope lit itself inside of me as I remembered back to that day in French class and our dialogue about the medication that Mr. Finnegan had called an extraordinary means of preserving life. Sadie's mom looked to Dr. Behrens, who sighed and ran a hand through his hair.
That's a last resort, and not one we usually consider. The risks are too high, he said.
But it could work, I pressed. It could make her better. Sadie's mom and I stared at Dr. Behrens, and he shook his head. It really is an extraordinary means of treatment. The survival rate is too low, and the chance that it would work is too slim. But it might, I insisted. Please! Mr. Rosen, Dr. Barron scolded. You seem extremely agitated. Do you need to be given a hospital bed and a sedative again? I folded my arms and glared.
I don't care, Sadie said. It's my choice, isn't it?
Sadie looked to her mom, who nodded, her lips pressed together.
Of course, sweetie.
Well, I want the medication,
Sadie said matter-of-factly. I know the risks. 25% chance it'll work, 25% chance it'll kill me. And if it doesn't do anything, then we already know what to expect.
Mom, don't, please.
Sadie's mom had started sniffling again, and she pressed her hands over her mask as though to hold back her despair. Dr. Barron's handed Sadie's mom another tissue. He kept a packet of them in the pocket of his white coat, I noticed, and I wondered if he always carried tissues, or if he'd put the packet in special before breaking the news. Why don't you take the rest of the day to come to a decision, and I'll check back tomorrow, he said.
I'm not going to change my mind, Sadie said, coughing softly.
She splinted her ribs with a pillow one of the nurses had given her, going so white I thought she might faint. Dr. Barron's gave Sadie's mom a reassuring pat on the shoulder, and then paused in the doorway.
Young man, shouldn't you be getting back?
He asked me.
To what?
I asked. But I could feel Sadie's mom wanting me to leave, since the nurse who'd taken Erica to get dinner would probably be back at any moment.
I think for the rest of the night it needs to be just family, she said.
Yeah, okay, I conceded.
I pulled off my surgical mask and bent down to give Sadie a kiss on the cheek. I rested there a minute, my temple pressed against hers, feeling the shallow rise and fall of her chest, and the warmth of her skin, and the reassurance that she was there and alive, and that it was possible we'd get past this.
I'm going to be okay,
Sadie promised as I left. I know you are, I said. Except they were just empty hospital words, the kind that you wish were true because the alternative is too painful to bear.
Chapter 26. Sadie. The medication was going to work. I was sure of it. Of course, my mom was skeptical and kept telling me about some miracle herb she wanted me to try. I told her it sounded great, just so she'd stop talking about it, because she was making me depressed. When Dr. Barron's came back the next day, I told him my mind hadn't changed. I still wanted the treatment. He seemed surprised and not altogether pleased that I wanted to take the risk, but for me it wasn't a choice. It was the only chance I had. And one of the things I'd learned at Latham was that you don't pass on second chances. And a secret part of me liked the idea that my fate would still be uncertain, that I was back to where I'd been for the past 18 months, unsure whether Latham was it for me or if I'd go back to my former life after all. Except now I knew. If I did get better, if I did get to pack my things and take my protosilin and go back to high school, I'd call Lane every night before bed. And somehow, together, we'd get through it. Maybe we'd even get bagels on the weekend or drive up to see one of Marina's plays or check out just how ridiculous Nick's house was since he'd let it slip there was a tennis court in the backyard. Maybe we'd even buy some albums at the thrift store and drag our record player out to Modesto, where Charlie was buried. Maybe we'd even come back to Latham and sit on one of the porches of the boarded-up cottages and reminisce. Dr. Barron's let my friends come visit that afternoon, and they showed up dressed like that night at the movies when everyone else had worn pajamas and we'd look like we were stopping by on our way to a dance. Nick smelled like he'd swigged a little too much liquid courage, and from the look on Lane's face, they'd had a conversation about it earlier. Wow, booze o'clock, Marina told him. Have a piece of gum. She tossed him a package of gum and he took a piece, muttering his thanks. Marina smoothed her dress nervously. Out of everyone, she was the most uncomfortable in the medical building. She was still perched on the edge of her seat, like she might need to run away at any moment. "Loving the outfits," I said. "Whose funeral?" They all stared at me in horror. "I'm kidding," I said, leaning back and closing my eyes for just a moment. I got tired so easily now, and the pain meds made me feel like I wasn't all the way awake. Lane adjusted his tie self-consciously. He looked gorgeous, his hair a little too long, and just the right amount of messy. I remembered the last time he'd worn that tie, for our fake dance photo. My mom wasn't in the room, thank God. She'd taken Erica to town for lunch, so it was just the four of us, me in my pajamas, and everyone else in their fancy clothes and surgical masks. I knew they'd meant the outfits to be amusing, but the idea that they were something I wasn't stung. I hated that I was too sick to participate, like I was no longer one of them. "Round of bullshit?" Marina asked, taking out a deck of cards. Everyone pulled chairs around the bed and Marina shuffled the deck. I was the first one out, and after I lost, I lay back, listening to them play and pretending we were lying on the grass in the sunshine, instead of in a hospital room. My mom and Erica came back while Nick and Lane were dueling it out to win the game, and they watched, smiling, at Nick's energy and Lane's psych-out tactics. And I was glad my mom got to see my friends, and a little of my life here, because I knew she worried I was making it all up, like I had when I'd written letters home from camp about how the girls were all my best friends, and then when she'd come to pick me up, no one had hugged me goodbye. I got the medication on Monday. Dr. Behrens came in and hung the bag off my IV drip, choosing the lowest setting. My mom pulled over a chair and held my hand, even though it didn't hurt. For a moment, it reminded me of what Marina had said about how Amit's parents had hovered and treated him like an invalid after he went home. But I pushed away the thought and other troubling thoughts, like men following me through a carnival and Michael lunging toward me in the woods, and the way my mom had already gone through two large bottles of hand sanitizer. I closed my eyes and pretended it was next summer, and Lane and I were camp counselors together, making sure the kids in our cabins didn't get bullied. I pictured him in a pair of cutoffs and his loafers, with one of those lanyard keychains around his neck, both of us in matching staff T-shirts. I pictured us eating s'mores at a campfire, the chocolate all over our hands. I pictured us sneaking into the same shower stall after I bet him that he didn't have the nerve. And I pictured the antibiotics dripping into my body and binding tight to the infection and making me better. Except they didn't. My fever spiked that afternoon, and one of the nurses gave me something so I'd stop shivering. But the pain in my chest was so bad by that point that I knew it wouldn't work. I wasn't extraordinary enough. If living and dying were really the same thing, then I'd been dying for 17 years, and I didn't have much longer now to go. But I knew that might happen. I accepted it a long time ago. My miracle wasn't a cure. It was a second chance. But second chances aren't forever, and even miracles have an expiration date. Mom's eyes crinkled as she smiled down at me, her hand in mine, her voice murmuring. "Hi, sweetie," she said. "It's okay. Everything's okay." I closed my eyes, wishing I believed it. It's so strange how the moment of your birth is this fixed point in time, but the hour of your death is always changing based on what you eat for dinner or where you cross the street or who you trust when you're alone in the dark woods. But I like to think of all those little moments that add up to the final one, because it meant that my death would be my own, the result of my life, and not just something that happened to me. Thinking about it like that made it more bearable, that we go back to God when we've had our turn, that some of us roll the dice less than we'd like, but we're the ones who are rolling them. When I first came to Latham, I thought this place existed to protect the outside world from us. But now I know it's the other way around. Latham protects us from them. And the thing about trying to cheat death is that, in the end, you still lose.
Chapter 27. Lane. I couldn't help but hope that Sadie would make it. That, miraculously, she'd live until the first batch of protosilin arrived. That what she had, like the rest of us at Latham House, was curable. But deep down, I knew the truth. The treatment she'd asked for didn't work, and she started to get sicker. There were days where Sadie slept most of the time, where I bargained my way into the room and sat reading in a chair by her bed. Sadie's mom sat there, too, filling in Sudoku squares with a pencil and the occasional tear. A boyfriend or fiancé came and went, bald and sagging, bringing bags of health food and looking like he didn't know what else to do. Marina sat with Sadie's little sister, playing board games and bringing her a stack of fantasy novels. And Nick came by, with drooping flowers he'd picked down by the lake, although I couldn't tell you whether it was Nick or the flowers that looked more wilted. On Wednesday, Sadie and I were alone in the room, and she was propped up in bed, making me paint her nails a bright purple. "B-," she said, inspecting my work. "You missed, like, half my thumbnail."
"It's hard," I complained.
"Well, you better fix it, since I'll probably wear this for the rest of my life," she joked. My jaw tightened. "Sorry," she said with a sigh. "Not funny. Please unremember every not funny joke I've ever made."
"So, basically everything?" I said.
"Basically everything," Sadie echoed, leaning back and closing her eyes. For a moment, I thought she'd fallen asleep, and then she asked very softly, "What do you think happens to us when we die?" I wasn't expecting that, and I wasn't sure I had an answer.
"I don't know," I said finally. "Maybe it's different for different people."
"I have a theory," Sadie said, "that life is gathering the raw materials, and when we die, we get to make patterns out of our lives and relive them in whatever order we want. That way I can spend forever repeating the days when I was really happy and never have to experience any of the sad days. So that's how you live a really great life. You make sure you have enough good days that you want to go back to." Sadie swallowed thickly, and I could see that she was crying. "Do you think I could go there too?" I asked her. "And meet you in our good days?" "I think you could," Sadie murmured, her voice slowing. "I'll meet you there. I'll wait for you there. And I hope I'm waiting a very long time." She died on Friday, less than 2 weeks before the first protosilin injections were given at Latham House. I wasn't there. Her mother held her hand as Sadie died, not of tuberculosis, but of the thing she'd been convinced would cure her. She would have made it if Michael hadn't attacked her, if she hadn't gone into the woods that night, if I had gone with her, if people were less afraid of diseases they didn't understand, and less horrified to find that somehow the invisible hand of contagion had come for them too. In AP Bio, I learned that the cells in our body are replaced every 7 years, which means that one day, I'll have a body full of cells that were never sick. But it also means that the parts of me that knew and loved Sadie will disappear. I'll still remember loving her, but it'll be a different me who loved her. And maybe this is how we move on. We grow new cells to replace the grieving ones,
diluting our pain until it loses potency. The percentage of my skin that touched hers will lessen, until one day my lips won't be the same lips that kissed hers, and all I'll have are the memories. Memories of cottages in the woods arranged in a half moon, of the tall metal tray return in the dining hall, of the study tables in the library, the rock where we kissed, the sunken boat in Latham's Lake. Sadie snapping a photograph, laughing in the lunch line, lying next to me at the movie night in her green dress, her voice on the phone, her apple-flavored lips on mine. And it's so unfair. All of it. After Dr. Behrens refused to let me up to see her and told me the news, I walked back to the cottages through the early dusk that had come with the end of daylight savings, and banged on the door of Cottage 7 until Genevieve came down and opened it. I pushed past her, not caring, and then I realized I didn't know which room was Sadie's. "You're not allowed in here," Genevieve called after me. "I'm looking for Sadie's room?" I asked, and she must have seen it in my eyes that I wasn't budging, because she took me to it. I opened the door, and suddenly I was surrounded by Sadie. The twinkle lights wrapped around her bed, the color-coded towers of books, the old trunk in the corner which she'd covered with Harry Potter stickers, the mint plant she was growing on the windowsill, which explained why I'd always thought she smelled of fresh mint. The mug shaped like a British telephone booth, filled with different colored Sharpies. The world map over her bed with a cluster of pins in Southern California and one in Hawaii. I wanted to curl up in that room forever, along with all of Sadie's hopes and dreams, along with her unfinished travel map and orphaned mint plant. Instead, I took the memory card out of her camera, and then I went back to Cottage 6 and tried very hard to dissolve. That night was unbearable. I didn't want to go to dinner, to sit at our table, just the three of us, as though the empty chairs were tombstones. I wanted to remember the table the way I'd seen it on my first day, when it had seemed the most vibrant of all, its occupants practically glowing as they sat there laughing. Now it was the gloomiest table at Latham House, and I didn't think I could stand that. So I stayed behind. Nurse Jim found me sitting on the floor of my room in the dark, scrolling through her photos on my laptop. It was the closest thing to seeing her again, to having her there with me. But it wasn't enough. God, it wasn't enough. "Dinner," he reminded me. "Strike," I said. He hesitated a moment. "I'll put you down as sick," he said. When I finally did leave my room the next day, it was to bang on Nick's door. He opened it, looking as heartbroken as I felt. I'd gone over there to yell at him, but yelling wouldn't do anything. "Gonna hit me again?" he asked. "What would that solve?" "Well, if you're not going to hit me, come on in," he said. And I went inside, noting a trash can overflowing with apple juice boxes. "God, I miss her," Nick said, sinking onto his bed and burying his head in his hands. "I know she was your girlfriend, but she was my best friend, and I fucking miss her." "I do too," I said. "I keep going over it," Nick plunged on. "And I really think it's my fault. If I'd been there, things might have gone differently."
"They might not," I said.
"I could have taken that guy," Nick insisted, coughing.
"You couldn't even take it when I hit you," I said.
He shrugged, knowing it was true. "I really want to be mad at you," I told him.
"Because we're in love with the same dead girl?" he asked.
And he looked so broken that I couldn't say any of the angry things I'd wanted to say. So I nodded and said yeah, because we were in love with the same dead girl. The Wednesday that the protosilin arrived, we all lined up in the gym after lunch. The nurses sat behind tables with piles of syringes, and I tried not to look for the place where Sadie would have stood in line to receive her injection. Nurse Monica plunged the needle into my arm, and the protosilin pinched as it entered my bloodstream.
Dose 1 of 56, she said, typing it into her tablet. Now, can you rate your pain for me on a scale of 1 to 10?
But I couldn't. It seemed so wrong to me then that there were only 10 options, only 10 types of pain. Because I'm pretty sure there are hundreds of types of pain in this world, maybe even thousands. And none of these are numbers on the same scale. They all hurt differently, and amounts have nothing to do with it. They all hurt too much and not enough.
I'm waiting, honey, Nurse Monica reminded me,
and I tried to concentrate on my arm, on the serum that was flowing through it.
2,
I lied. I can barely remember those last few weeks at Latham. I know that we lined up each afternoon for our injections, and that after a few days, the tightness in my chest started to fade. And that after a week, I could take a deep breath without coughing. It was strange to think that my insides were changing, that the version of myself who had been with Sadie was gone forever, and that as much as I wanted to live in the past, I had a long, gleaming future ahead of me. Latham House, which had once seemed to stretch endlessly into the distance, was now a relic of the past. The sanatoriums were shut down like they'd been before. We were removed from the world and then put back as though nothing had changed. But we had. Without internet, without our phones, without being sure we had a future, it changed us. At least I know it changed me. And when my dad's SUV pulled up outside Latham and my parents climbed out, Mom crying and Dad stiff but smiling, I knew that I hadn't belonged to this place the way Sadie had. That my home was in the real world, and hers wasn't. And she'd made her peace with that a long time ago. But that didn't make it any less painful that I wasn't helping her carry her things out to her mom's car. And it didn't make it any less awful how she'd slipped from my life and from her own. I used to think a lot about the future, but now I spend my time thinking about the past. It sneaks in, even when I don't want it to, while I'm sitting in a coffee shop doing my homework, or when I put on a shirt with my name inked into the collar from Latham's laundry, or when the teacher calls on me in French class. And I know that I'll eventually need to figure out what I want to do with my life, but right now, enjoying it seems like a pretty good option, since it's not like I can have what I really want. What I want is for Sadie to be there outside her house, waiting for me on the curb. What I want is to spend a day at the beach that starts with us covering each other in sunscreen and laughing. What I want is to take her to my school carnival and promise her a medium soda-sized wish if she can grab my hand on the swing ride. What I want is for her to grab my hand and lead me through the woods back in time to that first moment I saw her when we were 13. Maybe, if I'd kissed her at summer camp, things would have gone differently. Maybe then we wouldn't have caught TB or wound up at Latham. Or fallen in love. But we did all those things. We grew up, and we grew sick, and we slunk unprepared toward our respective futures. Or lack of futures. There's a difference between missing someone and mourning them. And I hold out hope that one day I will no longer mourn Sadie, that I will simply remember her and smile sadly, and then I'll keep going. Because that's all you can do in this world, no matter how strong the current beats against you, or how heavy your burden, or how tragic your love story. You keep going. It took a lot of things to make me realize that. To make me see the path as opposed to the destination. I'd been sitting in the coffee shop and thinking for a long time. It was getting late, and my parents were expecting me at home since it was a school night. So I packed up my books and walked into the parking lot. I climbed in my car and started to head home, my visor down against the glare of the sun. But at the last minute, I turned left, because I never had before, and because I had time to go down a different road.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Extraordinary Means by Robin Schneider. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Gary. Text copyright by Robin Schneider. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.